Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Full agenda today. We are going to focus on concussions, but I wouldn't be surprised if some of you got a headache looking at this agenda here. We're going to get a couple of housekeeping items out of the way here. First of all, we've been asked to send Senate Bill 632 with no recommendation to the Senate Revenue Committee. That just is a simple vote. So let's do that right now without holding a hearing on it. We'll just move it over to that committee. Senator Canope.
It's going to be a work session.
Let me open up a work session on Senate Bill 632.
Chair Hess, I move Senate Bill 632 without recommendation to as to passage to a committee on finance and revenue by prior reference.
Senator Canope moves Senate Bill 632 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Finance and Revenue by prior reference. Is there discussion? Seeing none. Is there objection? Seeing none. So ordered. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 632 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 755. Recall this was the minority teachers bill that we heard last week. And we were unable to move it at the time because we didn't have the documentation from fiscal. We do now. So, Senator Canope.
Chair Hess, I move. Well, we need a work session.
We're in it.
Did you open it?
For 755.
Reopening a work session for Senate Bill 755.
Chair Hess, I move Senate Bill 755 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Canope moves Senate Bill 755 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Good bill.
It is a good bill. I think we can do better than the last Minority Teacher Act law that was passed in 1991. So looking forward to passing this into law with more effect. Further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Excuse.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Roblin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Knopf?
Aye.
Chair Hess?
Chair Hess votes yes. I will be the carrier for that bill. It comes to me. And Senate Bill 755 moves to the Oregon State Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. And I will close a hearing on Senate Bill 755, and I will open up a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 721. Councillor Donovan, if you could do both those.
Give
us a quick summary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 721 expands school district policy requirements for recognizing and responding to possible concussions. It imposes on non-school athletic teams requirements for recognizing and responding to possible concussions. It is an extension, an expansion upon the 2009 law, commonly known as Max's Law, which dealt with secondary concussions in athletic sports in public schools.
Okay, and we do have some legislators here to testify on this. I know Senator Steiner Hayward is here, if you would like to come up, and Senator Mona Sanderson, if both of you come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Knopf, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. I'm the state senator from District 17, and in the rest of my life, I'm a family physician on faculty at Oregon Health and Science University.
You have the rest of your life?
Not right now.
Okay.
And I am fortunate to work with some extraordinarily skilled physicians in the arena of sports medicine, at least one of whom you'll be hearing from later today, Dr. James Chestnut, who have developed some really important work in terms of concussion assessment and long-term recuperation. We are reading more and more about the risks associated with inadequate rehabilitation after concussion. Post-concussion syndrome can be devastating to anybody, but in particular to our children. In 2009, we passed Max's Law, which required that high school coaches be educated on the warning signs of concussion and that kids be kept out of play until cleared by an appropriate healthcare professional after being diagnosed with a concussion. This is really great legislation. It's worked very, very well. We've seen a substantial decrease in kids going back to play in high school sports since implementation of that law. Currently, a significant percentage of kids, starting even at the fifth grade, fourth and fifth grade level, are playing club sports as well, outside of the school setting. And so it's time for us to expand the protections afforded by Max's Law to kids who are playing sports in other venues. And this bill is well supported by a wide range of people. It's an education bill, just as Max's Law was. It does not incur penalties. It does not change Max's Law at all. It's really just making sure that people who coach club sports are well educated about the risks, how to evaluate, to make sure to determine if there's a risk that a kid has a concussion, and then to make sure that kid is cleared by an appropriate healthcare professional before coming back to play. You have before you dash one amendments that basically just make it clear that we're not touching the original Max's Law at all. You'll be hearing from people with much more expertise, both on the playing field and in the exam room, than I. But I think this is a really important bill for us. My daughter plays club sports, and although it's a relatively low-risk one, in that sense, it's volleyball. When I see some of the dives she takes, I do worry about her head from time to time. So I urge the committee's support of this bill and look forward to answering any questions you may have.
Thank you. Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Senator Haas, Chair Haas, and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Mona Sanderson. I represent Gresham Trout Delwood Village in Fairview. As a retired public health nurse, prevention has been in the forefront of all that I've done in my professional life, and I also feel it's extremely important when it comes to concussions, sports concussions in specifically. It's interesting that, you know, youth sports coaches are required to have annual training to spot child abuse, but not for sports concussions. And my father played football in the 30s and 40s, and back then, you know, they just had their leather helmets. And all the concussions that he got, I can't help but feel that that is why he developed Parkinson's in the latter stages of his life. It's also extremely important not to limit this just to football, because we know that hockey and rugby, wrestling, horseback riding, lacrosse, basketball, cheerleading, and soccer all have youth having concussions. In fact, girls actually have a higher incidence of concussion than boys, and just because of the way the structure of their necks are and the muscle and strength and size. So, colleagues, I really do hope that you will look favorably upon Senate Bill 721, and hopefully you'll be able to work it. I do not like mandates, but when it comes to our youth's health, this is an extremely important bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senators. Can you give us a sort of how the dash ones evolved and contrast and comparisons?
Thank you, Chair Haas. Yes, we have been in close conversation with Dr. Chestnut and Mr. Kracke, from whom you'll be hearing later about this, and they are very confident that Max's Law is working very well as it's currently constructed, and don't want to mess with success. We're not going to fix what ain't broke, to use the vernacular. You may also see in there some other options for amendments that include athletic trainers. We do not think that's appropriate. They're not the ones who are on the sidelines with these kids. They're not the ones who are the health professionals who can clear these kids to come back, and we'd be putting them in a difficult and awkward position if we included them in this bill. I respect the concerns of those who wanted them added, but we don't think that that's appropriate. So we want to keep Max's Law just as it is. It's working very, very well, and we just want to make sure it gets expanded to kids who are playing sports outside of school.
Thank you. And just so everybody knows, Max is Max Conrad, I think, and we passed his father, I think Ralph, was sitting where you're sitting before this committee 4 years ago, and had that chilling tale and video. I think you were here on this committee,
yes,
too.
Yes, I was.
We sat in the House, too.
Yeah, and saw the House.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the dash one. I think I'm glad we're still using a carrot rather than a stick. I think it's a very appropriate bill now, so thank you for that.
Our pleasure. We were very glad to work with everybody to make sure that we kept a successful system successful.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Joey Harrington.
Yeah.
Who's, oh, it's not football season, so you don't have to be on TV right now, do you?
No, 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 I'm off. I got about 8 months off to do important stuff like this. Chairperson Haas, Vice Chair Canope, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. At 2 points in my playing career, I remember being knocked unconscious. One of the times I went back into the game. After every time I played, I went home with a pretty significant headache. Seeing what has happened to colleagues like Junior Seau and his death, his recent death, guys like Jim McMahon, who played the same position that I did, who now has significant dementia, there's obviously been a lot of research done on the effects of brain trauma and quality of life to former players. This information makes me nervous, simply because I don't know how it's all going to turn out, and I don't think any of us do. The fact that we're hearing about these players is simply because they're at the pinnacle of their sport. They're in the public eye. They're in the spotlight. But the reality is that this is the end of the line for how they got there. This is as high as professional sports goes in the NFL. It's been established that these conditions didn't happen overnight. It's a result of cumulative trauma that starts from a young age. Max's Law has done a fantastic job of educating coaches to the warning signs, the effects, the importance of identifying players with concussions. As a father of two young children who, you know, I hope will be playing sports someday, there's no reason that I can think of that this law shouldn't be expanded to cover the children who are playing sports outside of the scope of the existing law. The effects of not acting and not making this change, I think, are far greater than any possible outcome for making a change. And I would urge all of you to seriously consider making this change, as I think it can be extremely beneficial to not only my children, but everybody's children who play sports.
Thank you. For the record, Joey Harrington, did you start out with your name?
I did not.
Okay.
Should I do that? You, my name is Joey Harrington.
Thank you. We I know that you had a terrible bicycle spill, unrelated, similar, when you came back. Can you speak to that and this, and if there's any?
Absolutely.
Maybe there's not.
Absolutely. Chairperson Haas, Vice Chair Canope, thank you for the question. Ironically, I spent more time in the hospital after the bike accident than I did in 15 years playing football. I truly believe that had I not been wearing my bike helmet while I was riding, that I wouldn't be here today. I was struck from behind by a car going about 35 miles an hour, and I went onto their hood. They hit their brakes, and I flew approximately 30 to 40 feet down the pavement. I landed on my right shoulder and the side of my head. I broke my collarbone, tore the ligaments off my sternum, punctured my lung, broke my first two ribs, and had 8 staples in the back of my head. The only place on my head that received any sort of trauma was 1 inch below where my helmet stopped. And having the opportunity to see the effects of my helmet afterwards, there's no doubt in my mind that without the protection of that helmet, I certainly would not be here in this capacity right now.
Have you detected somewhat of a change in culture in football, say, compared to your high school years, college, versus high school players today, college?
Absolutely. I think part of the change, if I'm being honest, has come on the NFL's part, has come because of the possible effects to the finances of the game. But no matter how it comes about, I think it's important. When I was playing at a younger level, getting your bell rung was something that was a badge of honor. It was probably the reason why I went back in the game the first time I was knocked out, simply because I didn't know any better. Thinking back to all of the evenings after games, like I mentioned earlier, when I would simply go home with a headache, it makes me nervous and makes me wish that people were more adamant about the protection of players, and it makes me want to be involved with the creation of a law that will help protect younger players, because I think the one thing that has been, if there's one thing that has been, that's known for certain, it's that these injuries generally are not one-time impact, and that the long-term cumulative trauma can lead to some pretty devastating effects down the line. And so any attempt to protect children at a younger age, I think, is a wonderful thing.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yeah, I just relate. My football career wasn't quite as spectacular as yours, but you know, I do remember many games having to wait to watch the films to find. I played defense, but I'd have to watch the film to find out what I did in the second half, because I didn't remember the second half, and you're just fooling on instinct. So hopefully the culture has changed. And the only other thing I would say is I think you're a good analyst, and you have a long career on TV. I enjoy you, so thank you.
I appreciate it. Hopefully I'm analyzing here just as well as I do on TV.
You've done good here.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah. You know, as a high school principal and watching coaches who took this very seriously for a long time, some of the hardest part is the parents who think that one more play that my child gets in is going to be the one that the scout watches that's going to make the next level. Yeah. And I guess what I was hoping you could answer is to let those parents know that if a person has the ability to make it to the next level, someone will notice it and they will get there, even if they're kept out for a few day plays.
Thank you for the question. I agree with that 100%. I've seen countless times when the collection of your player's body of work is what gets them recognized on the next level, not simply one play. I've seen countless players who make one spectacular play and believe that they have what it takes to play on the next level, and the reality is they don't. I think in watching the development of youth sports, and more so the development of the parents of youth sport, I think that it's going to take some strength to stand up to the parents and say, this one time we may know better than you. I know that these are your children and you want what's best for them, but oftentimes in youth sports today, the chasing of a scholarship or the chasing of a child's moment in the spotlight gets in the way of a child's safety. And I think that by educating all coaches, not just high school coaches, but all coaches at every level about the importance and the dangers of a concussion can help to not put parents in their place, but remind them that while that one play that they may go back in for may create a one-time highlight, having them live a healthy life is going to create a lot more.
Well, we do thank you for coming down to the state capitol today and sharing your valuable insights. And I personally want to thank you. I know you're a true blue native Oregonian, and over the years you were on a national stage. And those of us in Oregon were proud of the way that you maintained yourself under some tough situations with class and dignity. So thank you, and thank you for continuing to be a good citizen.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. Sherry Stock, Jim Chestnut, and Jenna Sneva. Why don't you three come up as a panel?
Chairman Hass and committee members, I'm Sherry Stock, Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, and we're supporting this bill, and having Joey introduce the bill was phenomenal, and he really hit all the points. One of the things to stress is that with the Dash 1 amendment, that this is a standalone bill. This is not Max's Law continued. This is a standalone bill, and there are no penalties to coaches. That has been taken out of the bill. So with that, I am going to let Dr. Chestnut present.
Chairman Hass and Vice Chairman Knope, I'm Jim Chestnut. I specialize in sports medicine at OHSU with a family practice background. Pleasure to address you today. And I had the pleasure also of speaking to some of you a number of years ago when we passed Max Law, so I congratulate you on actually passing that. So as a physician specializing in sports medicine at OHSU, I'm really on the front line on a daily basis caring for student-athletes and non-athletes alike, as well as adults doing a variety of activities. Sometimes I see often 10 patients a day. Many of these have played through concussions and had persistent and severe symptoms, prolonged serious side effects. And you know, these potentially could have been prevented by such a law that we're looking at. And besides directing the OHSU concussion program, I'm also a member of the OSAA Medical Advisory Committee. We advise the OSAA, and I also am co-chair of the Oregon Concussion Awareness and Management Program. So I do promote sports and physical activity as a means of being healthy and happy, and I have three teenagers playing, you know, lacrosse and football, of all things, you can imagine. So I do think sports are healthy, but unfortunately, injuries are a common occurrence, and concussions can be some of the most severe injuries that can occur in sports. So we definitely want to do our best to be accurate and timely in our recognition and management of concussions, both on the field, in the classroom, and in the medical office as well. So as you know, fortunately in Oregon, we've been a pioneer in developing statewide protocols and management systems. And these have been collaborations through the OSAA, the Department of Education, the Center for Brain Injury Research and Training, the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, Oregon Athletic Trainers Society, and a variety of other groups. We've also established medical referral and consultation centers for concussions at OHSU in Portland, the Center in Bend, and the Slocum Orthopedic and Sports Medicine Center in Eugene. Through these, we provide regional support for patients and medical providers to assist with concussion care. So through these collaborations, these organizations got together and created this Oregon Concussion Awareness and Management Program, which you've heard about. And it is also operated functionally by the Center for Brain Injury Research. And with the help, of these organizations, the Senate and the House did pass Max Law in 2009, which, just for a point of interest, we all passed first, but the Governor of Washington signed their bill first, and so they became the first law in the country. So hopefully,
We're number two.
But we're number two. That's good. And we take a lot of pride in that. So anyway, this law has been very successful in establishing uniform protocols for concussion management in Oregon schools. And the OSAA, in collaboration with OCAMP and other organizations, have been really proactive in promoting educational programs. We've helped set up a lot of resources for schools to meet requirements for Max's Law. You know, of course, the no same day return to play was a new change. Medical clearance before return to play is important to document, and also the yearly coaches education. So these have been very successful, and we've been able to implement these. And so the changes that we propose in this new bill really would just piggyback on this. But we do realize there is a gap in knowledge, recognition, and management of concussions in non-school activities. These include youth football, lacrosse, you name it. You've heard some of them, gymnastics, et cetera. So we feel that really we're trying to create a parallel law to Max's Law, not change Max's Law, and have it oriented towards these club sports, standardizing protocols to improve overall recognition and management of concussions across the state. So the key elements of the law would direct clubs to develop concussion educational and management programs centered on coaches implementing these plans. Educational programs would be oriented towards coaches, referees, administrators, parents, and also athletes. And although the referees will be involved, you know, to help identify athletes with symptoms for potential concussion, removing these athletes for further evaluation, the coaches would maintain the main duty of removing potentially concussed athletes from the field and restricting them from returning too soon. And so those type of safeguards would be put in place to be managed at the club level. Certified athletic trainers are currently, they play a very vital role in the schools in which they exist, but they only exist in about 20% of the high schools and even fewer club teams. So that's why we kind of thought it'd be better to not have them be included as well. They also have regular continuing medical education and concussions. And in fact, they're actually the most knowledgeable individuals in concussion management besides the few of us that see concussion patients all day long. So anyway, you've heard about this, but given the really high numbers of individuals who aren't covered by this law, we really want to expand it to the club sports. It's really vitally important that these teams, you know, get the concussion education and that there's somebody responsible on those club teams to really exclude the player from participating until they've, you know, certainly recovered and gotten medical clearance. So fortunately, there are free educational programs available, so the clubs don't really have to develop their own. The OCAMP, you know, Oregon Concussion Awareness and Management Program website, there's a great program. We actually did a study in Oregon schools that validated a program called Brain 101, which is called the Concussion Playbook. And we did a study in 25 Oregon schools and found this program to be effective in educating students, teachers, and coaches and parents. And so it's a free program that they can use there. There's also great programs on the OSA website and or from the CDC website, which are free. So there's really no additional cost to develop the educational programs, though, of course, they just need to post them on their website. So in summary, I'm in favor of a new law which expands the concept of Masker's Law to club and other non-school sports. I support the version of Senate Bill 721 with the amendments as stated. And it focuses on the coach's role for concussion recognition and exclusion of players from play until they're medically cleared. And the referee's primary role is focused on recognition and removal of impaired players. And, you know, we also agree with the educational components, and I think this legislation will make a big impact on many of the kids who aren't currently covered. So anyway, I applaud your interest and support of this. I think it'll be a great step in creating an effective state-of-the-art system that covers all the athletes in the state. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor.
I'd like to introduce Jenna Sneva.
Chairman Hess and Vice Chair Canope and members of the committee, I'm Jenna Sneva, and I thank you for allowing me to be here and testifying. In 2010, I was diagnosed with post-concussion syndrome with 11 concussions, and about half of those were knockouts due to my sports. I cut my 12th concussion from falling down a flight of stairs during my recovery, which set me back. My whole life I've been an athlete. I played high school sports and club sports ever since I could enroll. And I was on the national softball team, and I was a national champion as a skier cross racer in the USASA in 2010, 3 years ago today. Since my recovery, I wanted to share my awareness and help other kids who are going the same thing that I did. I've created Taking It Head On. That's my personal website, and my participation in trying to get other kids to realize the dangers of playing on a concussion, and that also goes to coaches and parents, just so that they understand that this is actually dangerous. There is lifetime consequences for this. As an athlete, I looked up to my coach for wisdom, not only in the sport, but also for the injury. And injury management when we were injured. But as going through this, looking back, I realized the coaches weren't really interested in our injury, because any injury we had, if it wasn't broken, we don't need medical attention. And when it hurt, that just meant that the pain was just weakness leaving the body. We need coaches and referees to look out for the athlete's best interest, and that's their life, not the sponsorship. And I personally can't play sports anymore that risk hitting my head, and that's because I never was pulled out. One example is I got hit in the back of the head with a soccer ball during practice, was knocked out, and when I came back to, my team and my coach was standing around me. When my coach asked me if I was okay, I said yes, and he said, get back in goal and finish the drill, and I did. Going to the athletic trainer at that time was a symbol of weakness, but today that shouldn't be. I returned to play, and most of my concussions, even when the coach knew I had a concussion, simple as the knockout, and today now I suffer from permanent brain damage because nobody intervened. Nobody told me to go get medical help. We need to educate everyone off and on the field because we need to protect the athletes. We need to protect the kids from suffering the extreme pain that I did. I lived a year with severe migraines, the verge of failing out of school, high anxiety when in crowds, and still today deal with headaches, and the daily threat of one more injury can easily put me into a coma. In club sports, we played at an elite level, willing to risk serious injury and playing on the serious injury because we didn't want to be dropped to the B team. We didn't want to lose our scholarships, and we would do anything we could. As a ski racer, if we weren't crashing, we weren't trying hard enough. Tumble after tumble, I don't ever recall being asked if I was dizzy, if my head hurt, or even if I was okay. We were just told to get back up on the skis and up the chairlift to finish the practice. We need our coaches to be educated in these concussions because we, as athletes, don't want to say that we're hurting. And we need somebody there to notice these physical symptoms that we're exposing, even though we don't want to share them. One of the hardest parts still today is going back home to sisters and dealing with my club ski coach. He still asks me when I'm going to return to the slopes and practice. And that's the hardest because he doesn't understand that I'm never coming back. And that's daily things that I deal with. If the coaches, refs, and parents were educated when I was playing sports and they knew the dangers of concussions, I wouldn't be speaking here today with a permanent brain injury. And if I could save one child from the fate that I have and had to deal with all the pain and suffering, it'd be worth my pain and suffering that I went through. I don't think any other child should have to go through this. Thank you.
Thank you for your compelling stories. I'm looking at your website now, Jenna. It's, you wanted everything.
Yeah.
And I think you said something that resonates with any kid who's ever played competitive sports is you got to try and not get on the B team or make the team. And there's just that, you know, pressure that we have in our culture to walk it off. Or I bet you Joey Harrington's heard this a few times in his childhood. Just walk it off. You'll be fine. And so, you know, part of me wants, you know, I have young kids. Part of me wants to, you know, involve them in chess more. But I was going to ask you, Dr. Chestnut, what you would, if I have a young son, would you encourage him to play football? But you already told me that you have kids playing football.
You know, I have a son playing football, and I have two daughters playing lacrosse and basketball, the two highest risk sports, almost, not soccer. But I do think that sports are great because otherwise we'd be sitting here talking about how to decrease diabetes and other problems with obesity and childhood. So there's a fine balance, and we need to make sports safer. We can also do that by rule changes in the sports. We've made some by decreasing the distance between kickoff and return teams, no head-to-head contact. There's a lot of ways we can make sports safer. And by getting everybody on the same page, I think we're going to be able to move new information through the system better now that we have we'll have education systems set up. But, yeah, my son plays football. He did get a concussion this last year, recovered in a short amount of time. He's back there playing. If he gets more concussions, then we'll have to reconsider. And, you know, maybe tiddlywinks is the next sport. I don't know. But I do understand your concern, and
well, for you, I mean, it's like the cobbler's children have no shoes. It's
right.
Your son's playing football and has a concussion.
School.
Well, it is concerning, but you know, I think you know, I also enlisted the help of my fellow professionals to help guide the management a little bit, so I'm not too involved as the parent who wants him back out there or wants him, you know, too safe. But I show a picture at the end of my lecture of him wrapped up in bubble wrap. As a nice way to support him, but you know, it really, if you're going to get a lot of concussions, sometimes you know, in one sport, you can transition to another sport. Jenna's taken up golf. Other people can take up swimming or other non-contact sports, and there's sometimes a rainbow around the corner. And so we just try to encourage people. Yeah, after dark clouds. So,
questions, Senator Cruz?
Do we have any idea why? Females are more prevalent to concussions than males, based on its statistics?
We don't know right now, and there is some conflicting data about that. If you look at the pool data, but in general, it shows that females have a much higher rate in a given sport than males do.
Right.
Nobody knows. There's a lot of research being done in that area.
Okay.
You know, there's some conjecture about neck muscle strength, but that hasn't really panned out like we thought. So. It could be that females also report concussions more. A lot of males, my 15-year-old son doesn't say a lot to anybody. So, you know,
okay.
It could be there are some reporting bias and things like that.
The macho thing, right?
But there is a true increased incidence that we still need to study and figure out.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm reading this, and it sounds clear enough, but are we sure that this will include the judo classes and clubs and the other kinds of things that are out there that have... I don't know if they're really a club yet.
Well,
so there's a whole lot of other activities where kids can suffer concussions.
Ideally, this will cover those type of sports. It's unclear, I think. Let's put it this way. Max's Law had a trickle-down effect to the club sports. And the clubs were starting to develop programs, but it has not been consistent. And there's inconsistency between when a child plays soccer on a high school team and a club team. So this will help normalize that. I think that this will trickle down to the clubs. I think it will apply to the martial arts, you know, clubs, so to speak. But there probably will be some loopholes here and there, but I think most people will want to comply.
Thank you, Paul. Because, you know, the reality is that you assume that, especially in rural communities where I come from, that the trickle-down would happen because there isn't a club sport that isn't connected to the high school coach and in some way. They recruit somebody, whatever. So they're going to want them to have the same deal. So I see some of that happening. But in a lot of places, we have gymnastics programs, no high school. So I understand how the trickle-down doesn't happen. And how, with OSAA, you have a reason to do things, but as you know, OSAA can't control certain Olympic sports and other kinds of things that have other criteria. So how do we make sure, because I agree, I think this has to happen across the board, and it just needs to become the general practice, and I'm just trying to think, is there other things that we can
add
to make certain that kind of stuff happens, and how to get the information out?
Sorry to interrupt. It's a good question. The very last paragraph is for nonprofit corporations. Some of these are for-profit, certainly.
Yep.
Many of the leagues are for-profit. So I'm not sure how to make this more legally binding across the board, but I think from a legal perspective, I think it would probably open litigation for those organizations that weren't following this.
That's true.
I would suggest we're doing this a step at a time, and if we see holes, then we deal with holes.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
Senator Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank Jenna for what she's doing, and she came to my town hall, which some people have described after 2 hours of listening to politicians as trauma. So I just want to thank her for coming, and her mom came to our town hall this weekend and exposed us to the issue and what was going on. So I really appreciate her coming over.
Thank you. I wanted to, you all have a video, and that's a 3-minute video of Jenna and talking about her sports, her life, and her injury. So enjoy.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming up. Jenna, your mother's here, Rhonda.
Yes.
And I didn't know if she wanted to come forward. I saw the back sheet. I should have called you up together, but. And Representative Gilliam is here, too, if you want to join her, Representative.
In the interest of
this bill passing, I'll just listen. This is a great time.
Wow, that's a hard act to follow. Chair Senator Haas and Vice Chair Senator Knopp, I'm Jenna's mom, and before you think you need to arrest me for child abuse for my daughter not getting medical care, it's really hard for me to hear that. Even though I've lived with it for the last 15 years, we just didn't know what we know now. But now that we know what we know, we can't claim ignorance anymore. And Jenna's coach, Brad, was Jenna's, he was the head coach of Mount Bachelor, and he's been Jenna's coach for 15 years. And he didn't realize until this weekend that Jenna's not coming back. Jenna and I have been on this journey for 2.5 years when she was told she had permanent brain injury and to hang up the skis. And Dr. Chestnut was pretty clever in the fact he told her 2 years, and then Jenna worked really hard in therapy. And if they told her to do 200 pencil push-ups, she did 400 pencil push-ups. And these doctors like athletes because they overachieve even their rehab. But then it came the time when she was told that she would never be back on her skis. And that therapy was pretty much over for her because the recovery is within the first 6 months of an injury. And because she was traced back to age 8, her recovery was 3 permanent brain injuries, which leads her to a high risk of early onset of dementia, Alzheimer's. What takes us 6 hours to do, it takes Jenna 15. She is back in OSU and doing great. It's going for sports psychology, but the fact is it takes her 15 hours to do what takes us 6. When Jenna was first diagnosed in her cognitive therapy, to live her day-to-day life, she filled out 3x5 cards, which said, take a shower, eat breakfast, brush your teeth, comb your hair, go to class, do your homework, take a nap, go to bed. And that's how she lived for months and months. And to this day, she still has her protocol, and she puts everything up in the lineup of her purse, her keys, her backpack, and her jacket. And don't take them out of order because it's going to get her messed up, and then it's the anxiety sets in. And it's... And like I said, you know, we can claim ignorance, but we aren't ignorant to the fact now that these injuries cause permanent damage. Jenna was seen by doctor after doctor after doctor in Central Oregon when she had these concussions and was sent back onto the slopes with a medical release. Sometimes, I mean, there were 5 of those that I knew about. The rest of them I didn't know about because of the peer pressure, the coaches sending them back in, and Jenna not being on the B team. There's 5 or 6 concussions I didn't know about until she finally found Dr. Chestnut. And we finally found a doctor at OHSU that diagnosed her with PCS and TBI. But that was many years of Jenna with brain damage that we didn't know. And like she says, 3 years ago today, she won gold at national champions for skier cross. That was her last day on skis. And that week, she was up in Colorado and 15 to 20 times she took out the fence line that week in practice. And you can only imagine what that did to her brain. And she was at the peak of her brain damage, and we didn't even know it. Except for now that I look back at pictures of her, her eyes were so glazed over. Dr. Chestnut and the other doctors can't believe that she survived that. She might have a gold medal, but she has the brain of a 60-year-old stroke victim. And what this bill does, after talking to Coach Brad this weekend, and him finally realizing Jenna's never coming back, what this bill does for him, he says, it empowers him to be able to tell parents no, to be able to tell the kids no, you're not going back out. And that, after 15 years of watching parents on the slopes, and the way they get their kids to the top is nothing but ridiculous. I was there, I observed it. I didn't participate in that.
because I always felt like a good athlete doesn't need to be pushed, they need to be pulled back, and they need a balance. But there are a lot of kids out there that don't have that opportunity. Their parents are pushing them, and this is what we have for it. So the injury is preventable, the permanent brain damage is preventable, and we're asking you to pass this bill so we protect the next young athlete. That's all.
Well, we thank you very much for coming forward. I think you're a reminder that these injuries affect more than one person, that they take a toll on families and ripple throughout our community. And I'll tell you something else. For whatever difficulty your brain damage your daughter has, she came up here today. She was impressive. She was eloquent and had a very compelling story. So good luck to both of you. Is there any questions? Ms. Neva? Thank you.
Can I just add one more thing? Her three permanent brain injuries are short-term memory, peripheral vision, and visual learning. Thank you.
Thank you. David Crack. Thank you for coming. I think you helped us clear up some legal obstacles 4 years ago. And
that's right. And that's right.
Help us sort things out here today.
Thank you very much, Senator Haas, Co-Chair Knopp, members of the committee. My name is David Crackey, and as Senator Cruz pointed out, it was 4 years ago that we were having these same hearings with regard to Max's Law. I think what we did back then was just wonderful, and I think what we are doing today is building upon that success. As you know, Max's Law basically started a groundswell, started in Oregon and Washington, and it swept the country, and I'm not exaggerating. I don't think any of us can turn on the TV at any given time and not see something having to do with concussions. You look what Joey testified about with regard to the NFL's response, what we're seeing in the youth sports. Max's Law, however, what we could do back then, and Senator Cruz, you pointed that out, we take the bites that we can take. And at the time, we took the initiative with regard to high school sports. We saw a good nexus with the state and our ability to get that message across, and we did that. And it has been a tremendous success. What we are looking at now, though, is that there is, has been testified many times today already, a large group of our youngest, most vulnerable athletes who are not covered by Max's Law, and that's what this proposed Senate Bill 721 responds to and covers. We have recreational league players, we have club sport players, we have CYO players, we have everyone, essentially, who is not at that high school level. I'm going to just take one quick second here. Apologize for not handing that to the clerk first, but I've handed my statement as well as two other statements, one from a representative of Birdsong, a brain injury support group up in Portland, who highly urges the committee to pass this legislation or pass this bill, let it move forward, as well as a coach letter from Coach Brad, who Rhonda Sneva just mentioned. And I'm not going to read from that statement in any way except just the spirit of that. And essentially, he says in his statement, he wishes he had known. What we are allowing him to do now with the passage of this bill is to know and to move forward, and not only for Coach Brad, but for all the other coaches as well. I thought that the comment that this is a carrot, not a stick, was very appropriate. It's an opportunity to teach the non-high school coaches about concussions, but also about second impact syndrome. That's what I think brought us all to the table with Max's Law. We knew about concussions, but how many of us knew about second impact syndrome, that situation where you have a concussion after or while you're still in the healing process from that first concussion? I know from, I speak from experience, I was my daughter's soccer coach for about 4 years, from the end of grade school through middle school. And fortunately, because of our work 4 years ago, I knew about concussions, and in fact, I had a couple of players who were concussed. I wasn't covered under Max's Law. I wasn't required to take them out of the game. I wasn't expected to know anything about concussions, but fortunately, I did. They came out. They got the proper health care that they needed, and they returned to play when it was appropriate. I would expect that every coach in the state would now have the same education and understanding, awareness of concussions that I had at that time. Dr. Chestnut, just an incredible individual working in this field every single day, spoke to the need for this bill. He spoke of his firsthand experience. He spoke to the ease with which the training can be obtained through the OCAMP, through OSAA, through the Brain Injury Alliance of Oregon's website, through the CDC website. These are free websites, free classes. I've taken them, almost all of them myself, just to see what they are. They're easy. They are easy to understand, and they are definitely effective. Dr. Chestnut spoke of the need for education. His difficult stories demonstrated that need. They demonstrated the struggles of parents like Rhonda Sneva and the gritty determination of athletes like Jenna. In my mind, most of all, this is Jenna's law. We had Max's law, I think, for the high school sports. I think we're looking today at Jenna's law for the non-high school sports. Jenna is a survivor. She's a champion on the slopes. She's a champion off the slopes. Today, she is a champion for those other athletes who are going to be in the future. Hers is the story behind Senate Bill 721, and she's asking you to protect the next ski racers, the next club sport athletes, the next rec league athletes by passing this bill. And for the sake of all of our young athletes in Oregon, I think all of us who are testifying today are asking you to do the same as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We did have a question, Senator Roblin's question, some of those private taekwondo shops.
Yeah, it's a great question. The current standard is registration with the state. The language does say nonprofit registration. That's, again, we're biting off what we can, and we will fill the gaps in later. I think that perhaps there is a reason to say any registration at some point. I hope that this bill will continue on the process with the language that we currently have, unless it can be done very easily. But I do think, quite frankly, the smaller, the dojos, they are registered with the state. There is a nexus, and as a result, I think we have the state has the authority to require that education among those coaches as well. And quite frankly, I think it's a wonderful mechanism. I think that it gives us a nice in to all of these various club and sport leagues.
Further questions?
Just a comment. I guess my only disappointment so far was finding out that Washington signed Max's law before Oregon, because I hate losing to the Huskies at anything.
I couldn't agree more.
Some of us are Huskies, so it's okay.
You know, quite frankly, very candidly, they're a great group of people up there as well. Their Brain Injury Association has done wonderful things, and we work in conjunction and closely with them all the time. Just glad, quite frankly, the Northwest was clearly the leader on this issue, and it's something that you all should feel very, very proud and very happy for. Thank you.
Okay, our final panel, Aaron Crawler, Bob Junda, Greg Hill. Gentlemen.
Chairman Hass, Vice Chairman Canope, Senators of the Committee, my name is Aaron Kramer. It's E-R-I-N-C-R-A-M-E-R. I'm here before you today. Thank you for receiving my testimony. I'm here in my role as a primary care physician assistant in rural family practice. I'm here in my role as an athletic trainer with nearly 20 years of experience in practice. I'm here in my role as a volunteer team physician assistant for high school athletics, and in my role as a father of two boys who are avid soccer players, but not in high school soccer. I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 721 with the Dash 1 amendments, and to keep it brief and summarize for you, I'm here because it's educational rather than punitive. I'm here because the growing numbers of athletes who are not participating in public school athletics deserve the same protections and the same education as those who are. I'm here because Max's Law has been successful, and a step at a time is a great philosophy, and to move forward and extend that is appropriate, even if it doesn't go as far as we might hope it would. I'm here because it will help coaches and parents emotions run high, stakes, whether real or perceived, run high, and this will allow everyone to have more knowledge and allow their positions to evolve so that we can protect the youth. And I'm also in favor of the Dash 1 amendments because it, again, keeps things level-headed, removes athletic trainers who should be involved more in the education, the training, the treating, and the helping of the athletes as opposed to the rudimentary training. They should be providing the training rather than receiving it based on their scope of practice and their license to practice in the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Go ahead. We'll just go through all the questions.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junef. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. About a dozen years ago, Congress, recognizing that we were having a vastly greater number of people with brain injuries appear, really due to the advancement of medical technology, that it was time to look at ways to advocate for our states to move forward in terms of creating systems, services to address their needs. And part of that was some funding for our organization, Disability Rights Oregon, to help advocate for folks, because what you find is that people with brain injury are unique, they have unique needs, and the medical systems and our social service systems aren't well designed to address them. One thing is really clear. When you get some money like this, all of a sudden you're on a steep learning curve, and over those years we've represented scores of people with brain injuries in attempts to get them the services that they need, rehabilitative services, medical services, special education services that can help them to succeed in life. We're still evolving, but one thing is clear is that just like myself, we all need to be better educated about this injury. And one thing is very clear is that this is an equal opportunity disability. We could all have one tomorrow. And my goodness, if we can prevent our children from having these experiences, this is really something that we should do. I think Senate Bill 721 is exactly the right direction to go in. I think education is what we need. I benefited from it, and I think that coaches and athletes and referees will all benefit from it, and I urge you to move the bill.
My name is Greg Hill, and I'm the president of the Oregon Athletic Trainer Society, also an athletic trainer in the college and university setting at Linfield College. Initially, I worked in a high school setting for the first 2 years of my career and have been at the college and university setting since then, and have been practicing for about 15 years. Athletic trainers, I think, are very much in favor of this. They're involved in some club settings, but really it's kind of few and far between. I think the education component is extremely important. And with regards to Max's law, I know at the college and university setting, we've seen a change in the culture, even within the student athletes. I think the student athletes have become, in my opinion, truer teammates to each other, and actually don't allow their teammates to hide symptoms. And when they recognize that they have a teammate who is suffering symptoms, they report it or they take the student to the athletic trainer. And that's something that I don't think was there prior to Max's law. I just want to thank you. I think this is a great next step. I think there are opportunities down the road for some of the things that aren't addressed in this. But I just want to say thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Questions to these experts? Thank you for coming down here today. Is there anyone else who didn't sign up or needs to testify on Senate Bill 721? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on 721. And normally we don't do this because we like the bills to breathe and give it some time for changes to be made. But because there are so many proponents here today, I'd soon move this to the Senate floor if that's the committee's desires here.
Such a wise choice, Mr. Chair.
All right, so let's... I would like to open up a work session on Senate Bill 721. We have
dash one.
Yep. Chair Hass, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 721 dated March 7, 2013.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the dash one amendments. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Hass, I move Senate Bill 721 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 721 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Roblin?
Aye.
Vice Chairman Hill?
Aye.
Chair Hass?
Hass votes aye. Senate Bill 711 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. Dr. Senator Steiner Hayward can carry that bill.
Absolutely.
And thank you all for participating today. Let's take a 1 minute break and move on to dual credits and Senate Bill 222.
Have you seen Joey? I mean, he does he's an analyst for the Pac-12 Network. Does a good job.
He's good. I'm going to reconvene the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development, and I'd like to open up a work session on Senate Bill 222. And if you could remind us what we've sort of gutted and stuff, the original grand design, and if we could have Ben Cannon kind of come up and talk to us about it. Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 222, when the committee's considered it four times before today, five times including today, it outlines dual credit and accelerated credit programs for high schools. Accelerated credit is a method by which high school students can gain college-level credit while still in high school, be it through local community colleges or through programs taught with the help of the community college and high schools. There's a variety of different options that are currently employed statewide. The committee is currently considering the -3 amendments. They were adopted at our last meeting, the last time we considered this topic, on March 12th. The -3 amendments establish an accelerated learning committee to be directed by the head of the Oregon Education Investment Board, and directs that committee to report to the legislature about suitable options no later than October 1st, 2014. And here is Mr. Cannon, who is much more expert at this than I am.
Ben, you want to just come up? I don't know if you had an opening presentation or question.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief for the record. Ben Cannon, Governor's Education Policy Advisor. Just really want to express my appreciation to Chair Haas and the committee for their hard work on this important topic of dual credit. The Oregon Education Investment Board has established via its strategic plan some pretty ambitious goals for educational outcomes aligned with the 40-40-20 goals that this legislature adopted last session. Included among those goals for outcomes are that 85% of students would be on track for graduation at the end of ninth grade by 2015, that we'd increase our cohort graduation rates by 5%, decreasing achievement gaps by 5%, and improving the post-secondary enrollment of underserved students by 10%. I mentioned that our focus remains outcomes, but when you go behind the outcomes and start thinking about what strategies the state could employ to achieve ambitious outcomes, this focus on dual credit for high school students is clearly among the very highest leverage activities that we can undertake. As a result, we're really grateful to Senator Haas and the committee again for your leadership thinking about how the state could craft an investment strategy that really matches our rhetoric and emphasis related to dual credit and related to great outcomes for our high school and college students. The -3 amendments are consistent with what the governor proposed within his recommended budget for a targeted state investment in supporting high school students in the achievement of dual credit. I think you can't do much better as both a problem and opportunity statement than the preamble to this bill, the whereas clauses that are in House Bill 222 and the understanding they express about the power of this leverage point. So the $3 million and $5 million, or the total of $8 million that you've put into the -3s for Senate Bill 222, are consistent with the dollars that are in the governor's recommended budget that the co-chairs also carried forward in their budget, and we're certainly hopeful and very supportive of you moving this along in the process.
Hey, thank you. There's some questions for Mr. Cannon?
Well, I apologize because I was out of the room, so if you covered this, so what's the other $5 million for?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Canope. So as I understand it, the -3s fund within Section 4 two items that you look back to Section 1 to see. The first of them is the $3 million that is for paying for courses and test fees associated with college credit for high school students, particularly those who have been underserved historically. The second $5 million that relates to Section 1 sub 1C would support and bring statewide the type of work that's happening now out in eastern Oregon, northeastern Oregon. It goes under the banner of the Eastern Promise, where we have high school teachers, community college teachers, university faculty in a room together designing articulated course series between high school, community and college, and university on a proficiency basis so that students, beginning as early as their eighth or ninth grade year, can see exactly which assessments and which courses align with the path that they're choosing to take into post-secondary. It's really exciting work. I mean, the governor was out in Pendleton last week and heard about the doubling of college credit that this year's high school class will be graduating with. There's just been this explosion of dual credit, and a large part it's been driven by teachers being in a room, and not just K-12 teachers, but importantly, teachers, K-12 teachers, community college instructors, university faculty, together agreeing, here's what represents, you know, Math 80 or Math 100 or Math 120, and you can do that at a high school level as a junior in a way that's perfectly aligned with our expectations for college students.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read this, and in my own simplistic way, when I look at it, what we're doing is giving OEIB $8 million, letting them determine what the criteria are, what it's going to be spent on, and with total disregard for the fact that this sort of work already is or should be done in the Department of Education. So I'm looking at an investment of $8 million that's duplicative but outside of the Department of Ed, and the fact that we're doing this in OEIB to kind of cement it in place, and at the same token at the price of about 80 teachers.
Senator Cruz, Senator Haas, appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. Within the governor's recommended budget, none of these $8 million go to OEIB. We have similar language in a policy bill related to dual credit and strategic investment in the House, where we've described how the dollars in Section 1.1 sub A and B will be actually delivered through, if you will, granted through the Oregon Student Access Commission, and in C through the Oregon Department of Education. That has been the intent. That's certainly how we've proposed. That's how we put the governor's budget together. None of these dollars would be allocated to the Oregon Education Investment Board. The role of the board would be to help establish the criteria for the grant making and to ensure that this is connected to an overall strategic plan and an overall strategic approach to target investments that is coherent. But we certainly don't intend for the Oregon Education Investment Board to have the staff, the procurement officers, the grant-making functions that exist today already, as you know, within the Oregon Department of Education. And that's where we would continue to house them.
Okay. Mr. Chair, good. I appreciate that. Section 4 gives the money to OEIB, and in relative to Section 1, and in Section 1 it sets, they're going to set the rules. So I think it's hard to say that isn't money that's going to OEIB, and, you know, I understand that it's for X, Y, and Z, but it lets them determine how we're going to determine X, Y, and Z.
So, Senator Haas, Senator Cruz, I know and I agree with you that within this Dash 3 amendment, the appropriation is made to the Oregon Education Investment Board. That has never been our intent, nor our proposal, nor is it reflected in the governor's recommended budget. So speaking on the part of the governor, not
okay.
This proposal, that's not our interest.
Okay. I guess, Ben, I understand that, which is why I'm bringing that up, that maybe this isn't quite structured the way it was intended. I don't know.
Well, we are sending it to Ways and Means.
even though it disagrees with the intent from the governor's office, we're going to send it there anyway?
I don't think it disagrees with the intent.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I mean, I think this is it's sort of a question of where you draw the line between the Policy Committee's responsibility and the Ways and Means Committee's responsibility. When we worked on the House side and initially with Senator Haas on the policy, we didn't intend for funding allocations to be made within the bills at all. Obviously, that's the prerogative of the Policy Committee to establish that within the legislation. Our sense was that, we would work with the Ways and Means Committee to express how, you know, the amount of dollars that we have proposed within our budget and how those would be allocated. I would just defer to the wishes of the committee in terms of the extent to which you want to do that here.
Senator Cruz, Senator Knope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ben, am I interpreting from what you're saying that you would be okay with us just getting a amendment that says that the money's in Section 4 is going to go to the Oregon Department of Education? Is that where it's supposed to go?
So, Senator Canope, Senator Haas, we have proposed, again, within our budget, not within any policy bill, but we have proposed that the $3 million in Section 4 sub 1 would actually be would be appropriated to the Oregon Student Access Commission or its successor if it ends up being merged with any other agency, but probably the Oregon Student Access Commission. And the $5 million in Section 4 sub 2 we, within the governor's budget, allocated to the Oregon Department of Education. Because 4-1 are scholarship funds, essentially, and access to courses for high school students, it seemed most consistent with the Oregon Student Access Commission's mission. We are, I would say, very flexible, ultimately, about where those dollars would be allocated, but that's how we developed our budget.
I don't think there's any heartburn at all in doing another amendment that gets to some more specificity about where these dollars land. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
I'm good.
Yeah.
That'd be good.
Okay, why don't we do that then? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cannon.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 222 in work session and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 739. Senator Winters has been patiently waiting to come and testify for her bill, and Dr. Crew is here as well.
Yes.
I know she got a few things.
Yes, she does have a few sponsors on this bill.
I just want to mention that she made it here even after a long walk at noon.
Well, I was expecting Chair Haas and you good senators who heard me this morning that you were going to join me on the health walk this afternoon with the I Love Me and in recognition of the National Heart Walk that starts tomorrow. But Chair Haas, I don't know why I'm doing that today. Walk to Haas and committee members. For the record, I'm State Senator Jackie Winters, representing Senate District 10, which is Salem, Independence, Almsville, and Turner. I'm here today and thank you for hearing Senate Bill 739. Little history on back history. In 1999, and there's some members of this panel who were in the House with me at that time, we passed similar legislation that you're going to hear today, and it was signed by Governor Kitzhaber. That law was intended to develop a curriculum for use in Oregon schools that presented the importance of the state's many and diverse racial, ethnic, and culture groups, and including them in our history. The previous legislation had included in that consultation with the Oregon Historical Society. 14 years have passed since that initial piece of legislation that's on the books, and to date, it has not been implemented. Before you today, Senate Bill 739, the language is similar with one exception, that in addition to the Department of Ed working in consultation with the Oregon Historical Society, but also to work with our advocacy groups, which includes the African American, Hispanic, Native American, Asian American, and other ethnic groups. Senate Bill 739 would again direct the Department of Education to consult with these entities in developing content standards for Oregon studies, as well as when preparing material to support teacher training and classroom instruction for programs. Colleagues, it was then as in now that I believe that it's important that students know all of Oregon's history and the contribution that is made into Oregon's history by its diversity and diversified groups. I said in 1999 when we had the original legislation that it was important that the student in Coos Bay understand the students that's in the metropolitan Portland area, that the students in
in LeGrand, who Maxwell, by the way, I don't know if all of you know that the logging community that's developed there was developed a lot of long years ago by Black Americans, and that they also know about the cowboy in Pendleton that was there. So to me, I thought it was very important that we that our history that is taught in our schools reflect the diversity that exists in our state. And they need to know this. And with, if we don't include it in our studies, they will never know this rich history that we have and the contributions that the ethnic groups have made to make this state a great state. And so I bring that to you today, and I'm asking you to pass and work session Senate Bill 739. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Frederick has joined us. Can you join us? Yeah. Or unless you're here to make sure we pass Senate Bill 755,
yes,
which
I'm here
we
to
did.
Do that too.
Oh, okay.
Sure. If
sorry,
I,
you missed that one.
If I could, Senator Winters, you may have a problem because while you do have all 30 senators as sponsors, you've only got 40 House members.
My apologies. I didn't have enough time to get the other 20, but I'm certain that if I had contacted them, we would have had a unanimous
yes.
both chambers.
I think you're right. Representative?
See, I'm surrounded by two handsome gentlemen, so hey.
Thank you very much. I'll be very brief. We have seen we know now that the communities and the Oregon that we will be living in the future is a multiracial, multi-ethnic place that for kids to really make a real difference in the future, they're going to need to know how to live in that community. And also, it's even better if they know what their communities came from, what the contributions were to Oregon. You mentioned Maxwell, which is really one of the most fascinating stories. I don't know if you've gotten a chance to find out about it or not, but a Black logging town in northeastern Oregon that was really rediscovered only recently. The contributions of the Chinese community, the contributions of the Native communities, the Latino communities throughout the state, these are all things that are important, especially because kids... I did not introduce myself. I'm sorry. I'm State Representative Lou Frederick, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you. We have seen the many attempts to do this. Portland Public Schools put together a group called Baseline Essays for many years. They have not used those for quite a while, but that was something that did come up. There are other groups that have been trying to make sure that the history, there's actually a group of tapes, audio tapes that were done up and down the I-5 corridor and on the coast, which talk about the various connections with the various ethnic groups in the state. These are things that not only make the kids interested, because they are trying to figure out where they fit in, but they are absolutely great mysteries to go after. And I think it's something that we should make sure that we have as part of our regular curriculum.
Thank you. Dr. Crew?
I'm Rudy Crew, Chief Education Officer for the State of Oregon. Thank you very much, Chair Haas and members of the committee. When I first heard about this, actually, with Senator Winters, we were having another conversation, and she raised this issue, and I was sort of... It struck a very curious chord in me, partly because I assumed that much of this would have already been present in the course curriculum in the state. But then even more so by virtue of just knowing the demographic shifts that are happening across the state and sort of record numbers of people that it just would have, it made sense to be able to have a conversation both then and now about it. And I frame this discussion really more as how does a child or any human being, how do we develop? How do we understand cognition? How do we build new knowledge? And the cornerstone of this, by virtue of the science of it all, the cornerstone of it is human confidence. It's the ability for students to emerge from any task that they are taught more confident in their ability than they were before they started it. So it's confidence plus then a maximum amount of their own effort that actually allows human beings to develop. The confidence piece is what I see Senate Bill 739 really speaking to, because it's really about how we generate human confidence. It's the modeling that we see of people who essentially look like students in a classroom. It's the ability for people to essentially see themselves represented in some historical and present day and future context that enables someone to feel, if you will, sort of the intangibility, but the power of their own contributions and the contributions of their people. And it's also confidence is instilled by the home, by people feeling like there is something about my DNA, if you will, that has real power, it has real resonance, even if the task is hard, that there's evidence of us being able to do this work. And so when I look at today's dropout numbers, when I look at the number of kids who are not eligible to matriculate into a 2 or 4 year institution, when I look at the number of youngsters who are sadly not able to complete ninth grade credits and have or be on track for graduation, what I'm seeing really is students who lost their confidence along the way. This is not a matter of people not having the gray matter for this. This is not that they're not smart. This is that they just lost their confidence along the way. And I see bills like this, 739 and frankly others, as being able to say two things. One, we've got to raise the standards by which we actually ask people to raise their game. But we also have to actually then start teaching teachers and students ways by which their culture is a natural part of the building of not just the content of what they learn, but the confidence by which they build their own efficacy around completing this level of work. And so I stand in complete support, both privately and now publicly, with Senator Winters in being able to support the language of this bill.
Thank you. Representative?
If I may, Senator, I wanted to just give you a quick story. I saw something the other day that was really quite striking. A group of young kids were in during spring break, actually showed up in the rotunda, and there was a young black boy who was sitting there, and he looked up at the mural, and he saw York. Huge difference. He was included. This was really part of his state. This was not some other group of people. It made a huge difference. If we can instill that kind of confidence, as Dr. Crew has suggested, within a group of kids on a regular basis, this would make a huge difference to the state. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Senator Rover.
Question?
Just a short comment, actually, and a question. I am really excited about the bill. And the thing I'm as excited about as anything, I don't think our state has done a very good job in K-12 education and doing any state history. So I think it's a pretty clean slate, which is a real positive thing, because we can work on some stuff to get there. But, you know, growing up in Washington and having had multiple attempts at state history, you know, and learning all the kinds of other stuff, and coming here and having my kids go through the systems here and talking to people, I was shocked at the amount that we do not have. And so we have a palette upon which to write what our history is, and I am really happy that we have this bill, because it will highlight things that should make us all proud to be Oregonians. Man, some things that maybe make us not so proud to be Oregonians, but at least we can have a story. And I think by having the commissions you have put in here, the chance of getting those stories and the perspectives appropriate are much better. So I thank you for that.
And just to add, the stories are there. It's not as though that they're not there. And one of my reasons for adding this time the advocacy commissions, because we have a natural platform that's involved with us anyway. And also, I think it enriches all of us when we know and understand others. And that it's like a big, you know, you guys all know I like to cook, so it's just like a big banquet table, and, you know, we partake of my good gumbo, and I know the Senator Cruz would hope that I was going to make some this year.
Me too.
Who you haven't lived till you've had Jackie. Okay.
But seriously, we have a rich state, and I think it's part of the history that's not being told. And unless you happen to stumble onto, like the Maxwells or the Cowboy in Pendleton or some things in Ashland, Klamath Falls, I bet you that if you begin to look at this state and begin to really, really, I think Coos Bay has a famous person that was there as well as you study history. When I did Oregon, when I started and founded Oregon Northwest Black Pioneer, that was in the 80s, it was with the notion of sharing what we have in this state. And so, you know, we celebrated that during Black History Month and talked about the Pullman Porters and what have you. There's a lot to share. We have the old believers in Woodburn. And I can remember when we did a study of those in the 70s. So I encourage you to pass legislation work session so that we can get it to the floor. And I'm sure that, how many signatures do I have on this?
40 and 30.
Yeah, okay, you only 70. Have 70. You're 20 short, but, you know, there's a chance.
So. Thank you for coming before us. We got one more panel here.
Do we need to send it with that amount? Or?
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah, we shall. Thank you. Lucy Looks Baker, like Stephen Ying, Marie Watanabe, and Judy Parker.
Yeah, it's not quite as ridiculous as I thought it was.
About 2.5 FTE, so I guess it does need to go, doesn't it? Okay.
I'm afraid of this.
You want to get that thing off? Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Hess and Senators. My name is Stephen Ying. I'm the Chair of the Asian and Pacific Islander Affair. And I'm here to just want to thank you for the opportunity to support this bill. Our commission testimony already submitted to you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Haas and Senators, my name is Mari Watanabe. I'm the Vice Chair of the Commission on Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs, and I'm a third-generation American of Japanese descent, and I'm honored to offer my testimony in support of Senate Bill 739. I just wanted to give you a couple of quick stories from my personal background. My parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles were among the 120,000 persons of Japanese descent, of which two-thirds were Americans, who were forcibly removed from their homes during World War II. They lost everything, as most of you probably know, their land, their homes, their businesses. So this civil rights violation committed against my community was a story actually unknown to me until I was in high school. In most history books, this story is not mentioned or is barely mentioned. And my 11th grade high school textbooks had one line in it, and it said, "The Japanese were interned during World War II," and that was it. And only because my history teacher wanted my class to know more about it, did I actually start to learn about my own family's history that they kept secret from us because of embarrassment. So I never knew that when at family gatherings, when my aunts and uncles talked about camp, that they were actually talking about this incarceration camp. I always thought they were talking about summer camp, and because that's all I knew as a child, a great summer camp. And so, again, it was quite shocking to find out about this history that I didn't know about to my own family again, and it wasn't in our history books. So in 2008, for 4 years, I became the executive director of Oregon Nikkei Endowment. It's a Japanese-American nonprofit, and they built two projects in Portland. One is the Japanese-American Historical Plaza, which is a park on the river, and the other is the Oregon Nikkei Legacy Center, which is a history museum. And part of their mission is actually to tell the story of the Japanese-American experience during World War II. And one of the things that shocked me the most, I guess, shouldn't be a surprise, but every person that came into the museum to look around that was from this area always said to me, "I never knew. I grew up in Portland. I went to school here. I lived here all my life, and I had no idea that this history actually happened in my own backyard." So as good as these two resources are to tell the history of the Japanese Americans in Oregon, it's still not enough. So I'm really appreciative of this bill and the opportunity for the commissions to work together. One other story I wanted to share was the one of the Nisei veterans. They are the second generation Japanese Americans who served during the war in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team and the 100th Infantry Battalion. So they were most recently awarded the Congressional Gold Medal by our U.S. Congress in November of 2011. But again, a lot of people do not know this history of these men. They are, the, to this day, of a unit of its size and its length of service, the most decorated military unit in history. They've been honored with an unprecedented 21 Medals of Honor, 7 Distinguished Unit Citations, over 4,000 Purple Hearts, 7 Presidential Unit Citations, 29 Distinguished Service Crosses, 588 Silver Stars, and more than 4,000 Bronze Stars. So these examples are just a drop in the bucket of the Japanese American history here in Oregon, which is over 100 years old. And so again, this bill will help current and future generations learn about the rich and diverse history of our Oregonians. Thank you.
Senators, my name is Judy Parker, and I'm on the Commission for Hispanic Affairs, and I come to you in support of this bill. As Chair Ying already said, you have the paperwork in front of you for us. But I just wanted to personally say that, you know, as far as boots on the ground, we are definitely trying to sort of make these inroads. I'm working with the Hispanic National Bar Association. We've prepared booklets that are appropriate for children to read that sort of explain the role of law in both English and Spanish, and working with them. And I envision something similar to this, where students can see themselves in the pages reflected with all the great history that we have in Oregon. So I urge you to support this. Thank you.
Chair Haas and Senators, I'm Lucy Baker. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Advocacy Commissions, which include Black Affairs, Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs, Hispanic Affairs, and also the Commission for Women. And the paperwork that you have in front of you is a full house of support for this from all four commissions. And their opportunity to work collaboratively is very exciting to the commissions, and you can see from the caliber of testimony of just three of our 44 commissioners what type of resources the commissions have to support ODE and their interest in preparing an inclusive history. And we will all be working together to help make that happen for them.
Thank you. Questions for our esteemed panel? Thank you. Thank you for your testimony here. I have Rose Hill.
Good afternoon, Senator Haas and Vice Chair Senator Knopp. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to be here to talk with you today. My name is Rose Hill. I'm a member, a tribal member of the Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin. I moved here to Oregon in 1980 and been very happy here, so I haven't been back to Wisconsin too much. It's pretty cold over there. And I'm here today to talk to you about our support through NARA. I currently work for the Native American Rehabilitation Association and in Portland. And here to support the bill. And I wanted you to know that how important it is to Native people. I retired from Portland State in 2006. I was the coordinator for Native American Student Services for 15 years. So I saw many generations come through Portland State. And the opportunity to have tribal history be part of the great fabric of the Oregon curriculum is a wonderful concept. And I just want to support that.
Ms. Hill?
It's critical for children.
Hill?
Yes.
I'm sorry. We are right at the running out of time before we get kicked out of the room, and I do want to pass this bill today. So
okay.
If I could ask you to abbreviate.
Okay, sure.
I'm sorry. You just...
I'm the very last person.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I'm
well,
sorry, these senators run on and on and on.
It's all important work. It's all good work, isn't it? So I just want you to know that working with each of the advocacy commissions will bring the information, knowledge, and perspective necessary to ensure the history is taught accurately. I applaud your work to bring the standards and this level of integrity to our education system. All of our Oregonians will benefit greatly from this work. So thank you for your leadership. Senator Winters is already gone, but I want to thank her and all of you. So that's it. Is that short enough?
That was beautiful. Why don't you just stay right there, and you can have a front row seat here as we close a public hearing on Senate Bill 739 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 739.
Chair has to move Senate Bill 739 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 739 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Roblin.
Aye.
Vice Chair Knope.
Aye.
Chair Hess.
Pass votes aye. Senate Bill 739 passes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate, and Senator Winters will be the carrier.
We could have 30
right.
carriers.
Terrific. Thank you.
And we are out of time here, and with no other business before us, thank you all. We will carry over Senate Bill 211 and SJR 4 to another day, and we are adjourned.